Welcome to Backfocus, bringing astronomy together. I'm your host, Eric Wright.
And I'm Rowan.
Just as Backfocus is essential for a sharp image, this podcast is about bringing the people behind astronomy into focus. Every episode, we sit down with astronomers, astrophotographers, educators, observatory staff, content creators, and community leaders to hear their stories, learn from their experience, and celebrate the hobby that brings all of us together under the night sky.
And it is in pursuit of that goal that I have an event calendar for you, as well as some events within the state of Nebraska and a few other places. So come July 14th, we'll be having a new moon. At 9:43 UTC on July 14th, the new moon will pass over the area. It'll be a great time without any bright moon to look up at the sky with a telescope and get to see some of those faraway things. Come August 12th, we'll have the next total solar eclipse. It'll pass over Russia, Greenland, and Iceland in the path of totality, as well as a few other European countries. And finally, we'll have our next new moon on August 12th. So be on the lookout for that. Now, within the state of Nebraska, one event I have for you is a church called Calvary Memorial will be holding a VBS for kids that is inspired by astronomy. They'll be learning about the Word of God through the process of learning about constellations and other celestial bodies. And I think that sounds cool to me. So without further ado, I'll turn this back over to Eric for you.
Today's guest is Eric Lloyd, better known as Astropotamus. Eric is an astrophotographer, astronomy outreach advocate, and host of the Star River podcast, where he explores the unique journeys that connect people together through space and time. He's also passionate about restoring used telescopes and putting them into the hands of kids at star parties and helping to inspire the next generation of astronomers. Eric, I want to thank you for joining me and welcome to the Backfocus podcast.
Well, thank you, Eric. I appreciate the invite and I'm looking forward to our conversation today.
Awesome. Well, hey, as a nod to your podcast, I know that you like to do a sip of your favorite drink. This is not something I do on my podcast, but I wanted to give you a nod to yours. Today, I am sipping stream soda. It's just mug soda. So I don't know if you have anything on your side, but we'll clean glasses.
I always have some water because my throat gets dry when I talk. So that's what I've got today. It's the middle of my workday. No cocktails or wine for me here right now. But thank you for the shout out on the ritual there. I appreciate that. Cheers.
Not a problem. Cheers.
Cheers.
Okay, Eric. Nice name. So, so I just want to get to know about you, your background, and how you kind of got into astronomy. What kind of really got you inspired to do this kind of work?
So it's a multi-chapter story. I'll try to keep it short, though. When I was a wee little kid, my father got me a cheap, probably Sears, you know, Tasco, whatever, department store telescope. And I lived in the country and I had space to set it up sort of in a clearing in our yard. And there were no lights around to speak of. And there were, you know, beautiful skies. So I looked through this little cheap ass telescope and saw, you know, I tell people that I didn't see the rings of Saturn, but I could tell that Saturn was more than just a round blob. You know, it really was a cheap-ass telescope.
they usually are when you first start out.
Yeah, right? You know, my dad didn't know if this was something I was going to be interested in, or, you know, was I going to destroy a $1,000 telescope, you know, or whatever. So, you know, I understand. I respect his decision. The funny thing is, I've always been interested in science and space, but the telescope itself just sort of, it wasn't good enough to keep my attention once I understood its limitations. And honestly, it became a prop. I try to debate how much information to give you here, but, so the, the my life was complicated as a kid. I had a father and a stepfather. I call them both dad. It was the stepfather that gave me my telescope, but my first father was a police officer. And so I had like toy guns. You know, you're the child of a cop, you have toy guns. And that telescope became like the bazooka of my toy gun collection. Because when when you removed it from the tripod and you had the little, you know, the plastic mount thing that would go back onto the tripod, you could like bolt something to that and it became a handle. And then you had all these little extended pieces and stuff you could add onto it. And like, it was just perfect to like set on your shoulder and pretend it was like a rocket launcher or whatever. So it actually starred in a couple of home movies when I was a teenager, and it was literally a prop. But
that's fantastic.
I'm not going to drag this on too much longer, but there was one thing about this telescope that I thought was unique. It had a Barlow that came with it, and the Barlow had a very small little plastic sleeve at the end of it that you could use to just slide it out like maybe a half an inch to like fine tune the magnification or the focus or whatever. And that plastic sleeve was clear. And so the weird thing about this was they designed it to be able to do that as a Barlow. But then if you used this plastic sleeve and like put it down on a piece of paper, as long as you had light shining through that little plastic sleeve, it became like a little miniature microscope. So
oh, cool.
I got intrigued by the optics of how this worked, and it stuck in the back of my head. And when I went off to school, I actually studied microelectronic engineering, which is building microchips, basically. But a lot of that is, you know, staring through microscopes at the actual chips and looking for defects on submicron, you know, scales and things like this. So the optics was never too far from my brain. And when I became kind of a make-your-own-way adult, I got interested in photography, specifically wildlife photography and birds of prey, so eagles and hawks and things like that. So I amassed quite a collection of big glass for my camera, my cameras. And mind you, this is back in like the 90s, so I'm shooting slide film, you know, basically, and trying to get published, which I did get some published pictures. But at one point I said, oh, wait, I have this vague memory of, you know, looking up at the skies as a kid. At this point, I lived in the city. There wasn't a lot of skies to look at, but Comet Yakutaki was in town. And so I threw my camera onto a tripod and I started taking pictures of the comet. And of course, with slide film, you have to wait to see what the results are.
Yeah.
You know, there's no integration, right? It's, you know, if you take a 30-second picture, that's what you got, et cetera. Anyway, it was horrible. It's absolutely horrible. And I shelved the whole thing after a while. My wife comes along a few years ago and says, hey, you were interested in astronomy as a kid. I'm going to get you this Christmas present for SLOOH.com. S-L-O-O-H, which is still in existence. It was one of, if not the first sort of remote operated telescopes that you could subscribe to.
Oh, super cool.
So, you know, you got like, I don't know, 10 hours a month or whatever it was that you could aim their telescopes at a target and it would capture images and you would get the data. And on the one hand, it was really cool because these telescopes are on like the Canary Islands and Chile and all these sort of, you know, remote places that we're used to these days. But this was sort of brand new at the time. And, you know, you figure out
10 hours is a lot of time.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it would reset. So it wasn't just like, here's 10 hours. It was, here's 10 hours in January. Here's 10 hours in February. Here's 10 hours in March. And I wasn't quite sophisticated enough to take advantage of, you know, what that meant in terms of target selection at that time, but I understood what it represented. And so no matter what, I tried to make use of my 10 hours, even if it was just like, aim at the moon, you know, or whatever, you know, just do something. And that's when I started.
I'm going to interject real quick. That part of astronomy is one of the biggest aspects of astronomy is target selection. You have to look at the weather. You have to look at the location, the light pollution, the target, where it's going to be in the sky, how much time you're going to get with it. Because you might have 10 hours to shoot, but that target might only be up for 5 hours.
Yeah. And at the same time, I don't want to make it sound like, you know, I would just pick something, basically, at that time. I'd be, you know, they had a rudimentary version of what would sort of, like, if you went to Telescopius today, you could, you know, kind of put some parameters in and it would give you a list of potential targets. They had something similar to that. I didn't really know what I was doing. So I just, like, you know, well, that looks like it might be fun to take a picture of, kind of thing. But, you know, I am more sophisticated now. There's obviously a lot more sophisticated software than there was 20-ish years ago. More than that, actually. But at the same time, you don't have to be. You could just literally, like, look at the sky and say, that looks interesting. I'll see what happens if I take pictures of it. And, you know, if you happen to be taking pictures and the full moon comes up, maybe next time you'll make a note and say, like, oh, well, you know, that turned out badly because the moon. And maybe you'll choose differently next time. Or maybe you lucked out and the moon wasn't a factor. And so now you realize that, oh, the full moon might be a factor if I'm aiming towards it. But if I'm aiming away from it, it doesn't matter. So, you know, it is a learning experience, but the SLU got me back interested in it. And then I purchased an actual Celestron C8 telescope. I talked about this actually in one of my podcast episodes with somebody who went down almost the exact same path of what technology. A Celestron C8, a Canon 450, also known as an XSI, you know, a T-mount adapter for the back of the camera, and then trying to get that C8 to take pictures on a Skywatcher EQ6R mount.
Okay.
That was frustrating. I will say this about the process. It taught me a lot about the engineering of mounts and how the telescopes are actually made. It reminded me of all those optics stuff that I'd learned as an undergraduate. And to finally answer your question, I did start amassing some equipment to be able to do, you know, what we would today call sort of real backyard astrophotography. But I didn't live in a place that was really easy to do, sort of logistically. I still, different country, but I still live in the country. I don't mean different country, like, politically. Yeah, it's a different countryside than where I grew up, but I still live in the country now. And it's a beautiful sky, and I love to take pictures of it. But at the time, like, lugging that EQ6R Pro mount out, setting it up on the tripod, putting a Celestron C8 on it, mounting a camera and the camera adapters and cables and blah, blah, blah. You know, it was 2 hours of setup. And then, looks like it might rain. Undo everything as best you can and literally chuck it in the back seat of the car. And that was my...
Quite literally, I have the same exact mount right now. And it takes an hour and a half to lug this heavy thing out there. Now, I don't have a C8, so I'm not dealing with that heavy, heavy weight. Usually I was using like a regular tiny Rokinon camera lens, and that's all I would use. So the top wasn't that bad, but I just upgraded to a Newtonian that's a 6-inch f4. It's not huge, but it puts a little extra weight on it. And you always have to be concerned about the optics of your equipment. You know, you could toss it in that seat, but you're going to use that seatbelt.
Well, there were days, like maybe too many days in some inclement weather, where I was literally riding around with my astrophotography gear thrown in the back seat because I didn't want it to get wet. And yet I didn't have a place to put it. I don't have a garage. I don't have a shed. You know, it's either in the house or it's in the car or it's on the lawn. You know, there's no place to store things really for us right now. So it was very frustrating to just literally set things up, maybe get a couple hours of imaging, and then, you know, I'd have to tear it down in the morning unless it was going to be a fantastic day. So the progression there was I got a Telegizmos 365 cover. And that at least let me leave the guts of everything, like the scope and the mount were left outside actually for a couple of years, 24/7. And I live in upstate New York, so that means, you know, we get 100 inches of rain, we get 100 inches of snow, we get 100 degrees temperature. So, and we get 100 days a year of clouds.
I know what I feel like.
More than that.
I live in Cleveland, so I, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, It was better because I could just go out, whip the cover off, attach the camera, and be ready to go. And if the rain was coming, I could detach the camera and throw the cover back on. But it was still frustrating. And so I don't want to make this like an ad, but I will say that 3 years ago, I bought a SkyShed pod used. The person who owned it that I bought it from was buying like the new version, which includes a automated rotating dome and a slot, that kind of thing. So, but he had his old manual SkyShed pod that he was gonna sell. I bought it. He was literally driving to Canada to pick up his new one, and I was on the way. So he dropped it off, which was like, that was awesome. My wife made him cookies. It was, you know, it was a good old time. And
you know, it's a good time when the wife brings cookies.
Yes. So that pod, that SkyShed pod, for me, was the moment where I really started to feel like, okay, now I am an astrophotographer as opposed to just somebody who takes pictures, because my gear was set up 24/7. If it was raining, it was raining on the pod, not my gear. If it was a good night, even if it was just like, okay, well, it might rain, you know, at midnight, but it's winter or whatever, it's, you know, it's, as opposed to the middle of summer, you know, maybe I could get a couple hours before that. I can go out, open it up, and then it's still manual. I have to go open it and close it myself. But that's a lot easier to just be like, okay, it's going to rain. I'm going to go out. I'm going to close it and walk back into the house than have to tear things down. So I don't have to tear things down. I don't have to set them up. They're set up once, I leave it. And I've had that for 3 years now. And in the past 3 years, I have taken more images than I have in the entire rest of my life. Just because my equipment is available 24/7, basically. But that is the progression of me becoming an astrophotographer.
Okay, well, yeah, that's fantastic. I personally, my experience is a little different than that. I think I started because of COVID. I've always been interested in science and space and technology. When COVID happened is when I started streaming. And that's when I started trying to do gaming, and I tried to have some kind of social life, which didn't really exist. So I bought all this expensive equipment. I have lights, cameras, microphone, and then I got another job, and COVID kind of ended. And then the big moment happened where we had the total solar eclipse. And I was like, oh my gosh, I've got to take a picture of that. I've never seen one before. And I went out and tried to do the best internet search I could find as a professional computer tech. That's something I would hope I was good at, but I was terrible at it. And some people recommended this and some people recommended that. I ended up getting an NK-105, which is like a bird watching telescope. It's probably okay-ish for the moon. And I used it for the solar eclipse, and my experience wasn't that great. I just had a regular tripod. It was not equatorial at all. It was not tracking. And I wasn't taking photos. I didn't know what exposures were. So it was all new to me. But what I learned from there was when I jumped into my local astronomy club and I started learning more about astronomy. And it really is kind of a give and take. You learn information from the group and your knowledge grows, and then of course your equipment changes, your goals change, and your equipment changes, and it's kind of that loop. And so that's one thing that we as astronomers have to be a little careful about is just burning that hole, because that hole in your pocket gets bigger and bigger if you're not careful.
I would actually like to see those images of yours someday that you took of the eclipse, because I joke about eclipses as saying like eclipses are like sex and chili. Even bad sex and chili is still good sex and chili. And
this
so
is true.
You know, you only get like one or maybe two, if you're lucky, eclipses in your life, unless you hunt them. I figure like, you know, yeah, it might not be what you might see in a magazine or what have you, but any picture of a solar eclipse is still an amazing picture.
Oh, yeah.
So I'd love to see those someday. That'd be cool.
Yeah. What's ironic about it is I took the pictures, but the pictures that I have are screenshots of the pictures. No. I don't have the raw image yet. I'm kicking myself for that. I took it on an T3i Canon camera.
Yep.
And I don't have the raw images anymore. So I will have to hunt the next one, because I don't think the next one that comes to America is until like 2040 something.
Yeah. If you feel like, you know, burning through some passport miles, you can see a few eclipses in the next few years, but none of them are here.
This is true. Yeah. So that's kind of been my experience. Is I was fortunate to have a little extra money to go buy this and that. I didn't buy everything all up front at once. A couple of big ticket items, I did kind of pull the trigger and say, yep, there goes my vacation for this year. But it took about 2 or 3 years for me to really gather all the equipment to get the pictures I have now, which are amazing, amazing astrophotography images, especially since I got a cooled astrophotography camera. So now it maintains a temperature at negative 10 C. And I was able to get the PixInsight for processing. The software is actually quite expensive, but there are free alternatives out there to use that are just as adept. But once I started processing my images, they really started coming out. So the unprocessed is still raw. And I think that's something that I want to touch on, is when you're looking through your telescope, that's an unprocessed image. When you're taking a picture, that's an unprocessed picture. You're only seeing the bare bones. But the interesting part about astronomy and astrophotography specifically is that the data is always there. You just got to pull it out.
I tell people, I don't know how much you share your images with people beyond your like immediate circle. But I often get people asking me the question of, you know, I'll show them a picture of whatever it is, Orion Nebula, classic example, right? Everybody eventually actually probably starts by taking pictures of the Orion Nebula as their first deep space object, or one of the first. But even through a decent pair of binoculars, it's obvious that there's something different about that, you know, that section of the sky. If you've got really good vision, you might even be able to see something just with your naked eye. A cell phone camera can take a pretty good image these days and show you some even more detail. But when you start taking pictures with even just a, you know, put your cell phone camera up to the eyepiece of a telescope, let alone a dedicated astro camera or anything like that, Orion really is an amazing thing to take pictures of. There's just so much there. So I get people who ask me all the time, is that what it would look like if I were standing next to it in space? And this is where I tell people two things. First of all, your eye is not a camera. Even though it's very similar to a camera, the camera works differently from your eyes. So, you know, I can take a 5-minute exposure with a camera and I can gather light over the entire course of that 5 minutes. Your eye sort of is constantly gathering light, but it's not summing it. It's not adding the light that it gets now to the light that it got a minute ago. You know, it's like it's constantly renewing. So you can't physically like stack that image in your brain. You have to use a computer to do that and be able to get that either long exposure or multiple exposures that you stack to kind of increase the effective exposure. And the second thing is...
One day.
Yeah. $6 million man is coming, except it'll be $6 billion at that point. But but the other thing is this is the thing that I try to really drive home, is I'm an artist. I am taking... Yeah, if you used the same equipment and you followed the same process that I did, you know, this exposure for this amount of time, etc., you'll get the same data. But that's like saying, you know, two people in a watercolor art class looking at the same bowl of fruit, they're going to paint that bowl of fruit differently. They're going to choose to emphasize certain colors, or they're going to choose to emphasize a certain contrast in the light. You know, they're going to make it look the way they want it to look. And so I am an artist. You are going to see what I want you to see when I create that image and when I share it with you, because I want you to see purple. So I'm going to bring out purple. You know, you, other Eric, you might be like, oh, I hate purple. I'm going to shove purple to the background and I'm going to bring out the red. You know, so you're going to process that image differently. And to me, this is what makes astrophotography such an amazing, wonderful tool and an educational process and a artistic process. And to some people, it's a very mathematical process. But the data, like you said, the data is always there. And so there are sources of astronomical data, whether it's, you know, NASA makes all their images public. Some people share their raw image data just because they're nice. And you can go get somebody else's raw data and you can process it the way you want. So you don't even need to have a telescope or a camera or, you know, you don't even need to be able to see the sky because you live in downtown Manhattan. And you can go be an astrophotographer sort of adjacent, I guess, by processing the data that other people took. And again, you're going to process it differently than I am going to process it. And I'm going to process it differently from the person next door to me. And I think that's what's so wonderful about this hobby is I am always learning something because there is always somebody else who did it differently. And when I see the difference, even something as common as the Orion Nebula or M31 or these sort of classic things that are up there, I see a picture somebody else took of it and I'm like, wow, I never noticed that detail before. You know, that dust or that shadow looking thing or these colors or whatever. It's like, how did they do that? And you ask them the question and they're like, oh, well, I did this and I did that and I did it in this order or whatever. And I'm like, oh, I've always been doing the same things, but in a different order. And in this world, order makes a difference. So, you know, just, I guess it's very similar to cooking in that, you know, every chocolate chip cookie is basically the same ingredients, but grandma's chocolate chip cookies are different than, you know, your chocolate chip cookies because you make them differently. And I think that's what really keeps me in the world of astrophotography and astronomy in general, because I think anybody can do it. You don't have to spend a lot of money on it. You don't have to spend any money on it these days. Mm-hmm. And you can still reap most of the benefits of doing that and learn an amazing amount of stuff about the sky above us.
Yeah,
absolutely. And honestly, that's something that I've learned through building the CVAS website. I built the astronomy imaging tool. And one of the guys asked me, hey, can we put other surveys on here? And as we started going back and forth with surveys, we started noticing certain objects in the sky that aren't labeled. And we as a group have already, well, at least one person in our group has already discovered a planetary nebula. And he's working on confirming that data. But this is something we can do now. And we don't have ginormous, expensive $1,000 telescopes. I will say that the mount I have, the whole rig I've got, I probably dropped probably about $2,000 or $3,000 on it. But realistically, you could take a small, as long as a tracker, they probably cost $100, $200, something like that, maybe a little more. And you could throw a DSLR camera that you might already have from your COVID streaming days. A lot of people bought cameras and a lot of people bought microphones that they could use for astronomy. And all you would need is a camera lens. That's what I use, is Rokinon camera lens. Mm-hmm. And I at first used a Canon camera. That's what I used to initially start my photography. Was it the best? No, because I was still learning it. If I took that same equipment today, I would make a lot better pictures because I've been through the rigor of setting up my equipment for 3 hours, not being able to find Jupiter.
Right.
You know, now I can get fully polar aligned in about 20, 30 minutes. And that took me a long time of doing the same thing over and over and over again and failing. And I'm going to tell you, there's nothing worse than going out to the site and every single time something goes wrong. Every single time.
Yeah.
Without a doubt, something breaks. Well, I don't know if that's just me.
Or no, it's not just you. And even so, you know, I talk about having the Skyshed pod and how awesome it is to just sort of have this like permanent observatory in my backyard kind of thing. Even still, you know, it's 50 yards for me to walk from the back door to the pod. It's not that far, right? It's not like I'm hiking across a 5-acre field or whatever. And yet there are times where like I've gone out and I've opened the pod and I've, you know, sort of gotten things ready to go or whatever. And, you know, I come back inside. And of course, these days I have a network connection out there. So everything is remote. I don't have to actually be in the pod if I'm doing imaging. And I go back inside and I wait for everything to get dark or whatever. And I'm setting up my imaging run. And then I start my, you know, my autofocus or whatever it is that I'm doing. And the images are coming back, you know, blank or totally gray or whatever. And I'm like, what's going on? And I finally ended up getting just some cheap Wi-Fi cameras that I have aimed. Some of them are aimed at the camera, some are at the telescope. Some of them are aimed like down the axis of the scope, so you can kind of see what the telescope is looking at. So I finally got smart, got one of these cameras and had it aimed at the scope. And I'm looking at it and I'm like, I left the lens cap on, or, you know, the cap on the front of the scope. And it's like, oh man, at this point, I almost feel like I want that sense of I messed up and the universe is against me and everything. And again, it's 50 yards. It's 100 yards round trip to go out there, take the cap off and walk back in the house. It takes me all of, you know, a minute, whatever. And yet there are times I'm like, man, screw that. I'm just going to leave it. I'm not going to take images tonight because I messed up. You know, it's like self-punishment there because I forgot to take the cap off the telescope or whatever.
And so, that's something that I want to touch on is the community of astronomers. I'll give you a good example. I was at Observatory Park with my friend Willie, and I think it was just us at a time. And then later on, some other guys came out there. But for a solid hour and a half, 2 hours, we troubleshot an issue where I would take a picture, and the stars looked like they were doubled. And I was like, what in the world is going on? I don't understand this. I would take a picture. I would take flats. Every single image I had doubled images. I'm like, I focused. The autofocus worked, but it wouldn't find where I was going. And eventually, it took me a long time to find out that I had turned on annotations in Nina. And all those extra stars were very tiny words for the stars. They were labels of the stars. And I was like, are you freaking kidding me? So I was taking actual pictures. Those were not ever imaged. So I wasted 2 hours on troubleshooting this. And I could have given up if it wasn't for the fact that Willie was there also. And Willie was saying, no, Eric, let's troubleshoot this. Let's figure it out. You know, go through the problems. And that is what I love about astronomy, is that I can say, hey, man, you're imaging tonight. He's like, yep. And so we both show up at the same place, or he can come over to my house or whatever. And there's been times where I've literally been like, I think I'm just going to quit. And he's like, no, let's take another look at it, see what happens. And it's that extra push. And then I'll come around the next day and I'll be like, I got 4 hours on this target, which is fantastic. 4 hours is still 4 hours of data. You could have gotten 10, but 4 is still really good. So I really want to emphasize that. Have you ever had that experience yourself?
Almost every day. Now, for me, it's a little bit different. This is going to sound weird with all the connectivity and outreach that I do in the world of astronomy. I'm not a member of any astronomy clubs, so I do things sort of off to the side and remote and whatever. But I do outreach programs for local like community centers and things like that. And so I'm engaged with people who ask me questions, like they want to get into the hobby. And now I'm their mentor or whatever. And so I hope I answer questions correctly when people ask me whatever the question is that they have. But if they ask me something that I don't know, or if I am having some sort of equipment issue that I can't figure out, then, you know, for better or for worse, we live in an interconnected world these days. And
yeah,
there are such huge online communities in the world of astronomy and astrophotography. And if you're into, you know, helioseismology, you can do that. If you,
yeah,
if you have a small radio antenna in your backyard and you're doing radio astronomy, there's groups for that. You know, it's just whatever aspect of astronomy or space science in general that you're interested in, there's a group or thousands of groups that you can connect to online. And I find that it is, for me, it's often like you said, you did this task, you thought you were doing things right, and then you had like these, as you call it, these double images or whatever, and you couldn't figure it out. So for me, if I have something similar, it usually tends to be something related to my gear, that I added a new piece of equipment and I thought I understood how it worked or how it should be connected or whatever, and it turns out things aren't working. I will go to an online community of some sort, ask my question, and inevitably someone will say, well, you know, I have that same problem because, or I had that same problem because I have that same equipment, and here's the problem, here's the solution, get back to me, let me know how it worked. So, you know, it's a bit like doing a pen pal type thing back in the day,
yeah,
as opposed to being in the same room. But the effect is the same. I get my assistance, or I can ask questions on behalf of people who ask me questions. Mm-hmm. And it's like a glorious time to be alive, I think. And I say that not jokingly. You know, the sum total of human knowledge is basically available on your phone. It's an amazing thing. And people are so willing to share that information, share that knowledge, share their experience in, well, it's in many hobbies, it's in many fields like that. But, you know, I think there's something in the world of astrophotography specifically that people really want to share what they've done, both as a, you know, like a finished product. Here's the picture I took of, you know, fill in the blank astronomical object. But then they also want to help somebody else take that same picture. And so they want to share their technique. They want to share their processing. They want to share their equipment. They want to help other people. And I don't know of any other hobby or activity that I am involved with anyway that has that same sense of sort of like unconditional sharing. You know, there are things that I'm involved in, but they're often based on some sort of competition. Even if it's just like bowling night, you know, if you're going bowling, you want to win. You want that trophy, et cetera. And so, yeah, you might help somebody figure out how to bowl the ball better, but you don't want to give away all your secrets, right? You know, so astrophotography, I think, is a little bit different in that people are willing to give away their secrets because they have such a joy of sharing that information and seeing other people take up the hobby. And, you know, I remember the first time I helped somebody with their equipment problems, and they came back to me and said, you know, so excited, like, look at this picture I took of, you know, whatever it was.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh my God, I can't believe I took this picture. You know, it's like, that's the joy. That's why you do it. That's why I do it.
That's exactly right. Astronomy treats me a lot like Linux treats me. Linux, I 100% would love to just switch from Windows to Linux. And I always have an issue with Linux. Something happens, something breaks. And back in the day, you had to write your own drivers. And every time there was an update, everything broke and you had to fix it yourself. Astronomy is kind of in that niche. There's people there with you who know how to fix it too. So it's a little technical, but if you put a little bit of troubleshooting thought into the issue, usually you figure out the problem and you figure it out pretty quickly. And if you don't, there's always another night. Most, I would say at least 80% of my astrophotography imaging sessions, I've chalked up to experience. I didn't come away with a good image from that one, but I learned a lot that night. I bonded with friends and I had a lot of fun. And it was just another bit of experience to know, hey, maybe don't do that. Don't turn on the annotations next time. But I did want to hop into the astronomy spotlight section of the show. I want to ask you what your favorite object is, for like your favorite Messier object.
That would be M81, Bodhi's Galaxy.
Okay.
And it's not maybe the most, you know, glamorous or you know, there's not a lot going on there. It's just a galaxy, right? I mean, that sounds so jaded, I guess, but it's not flashy in any sense. But the reason it's my favorite, there's two reasons actually. One of them is like, it's always there. It's in the northern sky, it's circumpolar. Mm-hmm. You can image it almost any day of any, or any night of any day of the year. And because of that, it is one of the most photographed galaxies. And it is also, it's to me, it's such a great kind of, if you asked a five-year-old kid who knew something about science or space to say, like, draw me a galaxy, they're going to draw M81.
yeah, that's what we see. Yeah,
that it's like, it's this like classic galaxy shape, and we see it mostly sort of at an angle, but kind of edge on. And it's just, anytime I don't know what else I'm going to take a picture of, basically, I take pictures of M81. And I don't know how many hours and hours and hours and hours of data I have on that now. But
I would be curious. So your frame of view, are you only looking at M81 like close crop? Or are you kind of zoomed out a bit where you could possibly get the Vulcan Nebula as well?
So with the equipment that I currently have that I'm taking images with, it's predominantly M81. Okay. M82 is in there as well.
Okay. Well, here's an interesting thought experiment that somebody told me about these two galaxies. So M81 is huge compared to M82. I think, okay, so Bodes is huge compared to Cigar Galaxy. But if you were in the Cigar Galaxy, they're so close that Bodes would actually fill up the entire night sky for you. Could you put yourself in a planet in the Cigar Galaxy and imagine looking up at that galaxy?
I do this thought experiment with some of the guests on my Star River podcast, and it's that basic concept of, you know, we look at the night sky and we see constellations that we've kind of drawn lines between stars over the generations, different cultures and all that. But we're mapping like a three-dimensional universe onto a two-dimensional virtual surface, the quote surface of the sky. And so we have no real idea of how far away things are from each other out there. We just see like, oh, there's the Big Dipper, right? You draw a line, you got a Big Dipper or plow, whatever you want to call it. But those stars are in three dimensions. They're like, if you were standing next to one of them, you're not going to, the other ones are going to be in completely different places. They're not like in a line anymore. And so that whole idea of, can you imagine yourself in another place, what that universe would look like from that place? You have just kind of hit upon one of my favorite things. And that is the closest that we have right now to being able to see a sky filled with some other galaxy is if you are living in the southern hemisphere of the Earth, you get to see the Magellanic Clouds, which I'm told, you know, they look great and wonderful and all that, but they're just sort of bright smudges of light. They're not that big, all things considered, and so forth. They don't fill your vision. But you just described something which I think is amazing. It's the only place I know where you could be in one galaxy and another galaxy is basically going to fill the vast majority of your night sky. It'd be kind of like being on, you know, Titan and having Saturn fill your night sky or whatever.
Yeah.
I think that would be awesome. And I also think it would dramatically change the culture and the mythology and the history of us or whoever the beings are that live there. Because like our night sky is dominated by the moon, and it's been exactly the same for, you know, countless generations. If you looked up at the night sky and saw M81 as your predominant thing in the night sky, I can only imagine like what mythologies would be built around that. as opposed to the moon, which is like, you know, it's just a little disc of light. It's just, you know, well, it changes based on the phase, but, you know, it's not like it has orbiting stars around it and a central bulge and all this other stuff. It's just, it really kind of ties all this together to me as to like, why do we look at the stars? Why do we look at the sky? And I think it's to feel connected. And if we don't actually have a connection, our brains are wired to make connections. And so I think that in particular is something where I think just it boggles my mind to think what kind of connections we might make if our night sky was filled with a galaxy.
Yeah, that it blew my mind when my friend Patrick tossed it to me as well. That was one of those things where you kind of sit there. Because here's the thing, when you get your astronomy equipment set up, you got nothing else to do for the rest of the night. You just kind of sit around a campfire and talk. And that's amazing. Is I learned this. I had this stuck in my head when that happened. And I was like, are you serious? That just blew my mind the whole night, just trying to imagine myself seeing this entire galaxy. Like, it's not, my mind would be blown just seeing Saturn. But if I saw a galaxy, that just utterly, like, I just want to go in a coma. It just blows my mind. So I just wanted to toss that one out there. I love that object as well. You're right. It's right by Polaris. So it's always there year round. You can see this target.
Yeah.
You can image it. And it's a perfect object, especially for, and I want to toss it out there, the Vulcan Nebula. Because it's so faint, you need so much integration on it. It's perfect because it's right there in the Northern Hemisphere. You can image that target, put a lot of time on it. This is actually the Bode's Galaxy and the Vulcan Nebula are actually one of my favorites that I image, because as a group in our astronomy society, that is our kind of, I don't have anything else to image tonight. I guess I'll just image that because it's always there. So that's one of the things I always image. So I've got tons of data in that spot as well. So I wanted to go ahead and move on to the community corner section of it. Do you have any upcoming events, outreach, or ways to get involved, or important announcements for your area that you would like to put out there for your community?
So I'm going to preface that by saying again, I'm not involved in any formal astronomy organizations. So my outreach is predominantly done these days through the Star River podcast and through events that are done through the Parks and Rec kind of thing.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And right now, the next sort of formal scheduled event that I'm involved with is actually an introduction to astrophotography that I'm doing for a local art group. They were amazed when I showed them what one can do with even just a very simple rig, similar to what you use with your Roki. For doing astrophotography, there's some photography people in the group, and they asked me to be a speaker. So coming up on October, I'll be doing that with an art group here locally. But like I said, most of what I do these days is one of two things in the world of astronomy anyway, is trying to bring people together through the Star River podcast so that they can hear what other people are doing, very similar to what you're doing here, but with kind of a different focus, I guess. Not to steal your back focus word there for a second, but then I do, as you mentioned in when you introduced me, I am constantly on the lookout for what I call discarded treasures of people who are like, you know, here's that crappy telescope from Sears, right? That Eric had as a kid, and now he's using it as a prop toy gun. When Eric doesn't need it anymore, it goes to, you know, Goodwill or whatever. But a lot of times these telescopes still have a lot of value in them to somebody who's never had a telescope before. So I am constantly looking for, especially like little 4-inch cats, that kind of thing, which they're hard to break really. Mm-hmm. You can't drop something in the end and crack your mirror if you've got a newt or something like that. So I really like that. Kind of that's my sweet spot. But I get them, I clean them up, I refurbish them, and then I give them away.
Nice.
And that's kind of what I do for my outreach and all. But everything I do is done either through my webpage of astropotamus.com or thestarriver.com. Just sort of, like I said, not really involved in any kind of formal organization like that.
So you did just kind of tell us where we could find you at. So if you guys want to recap on that, the Star River podcast, he is Astropotamus. And you can find him, I believe it's starriver.com, right?
It is thestarriver.com. I don't know what happens if you go just to starriver.com, but that's definitely not me.
Same thing for Back Focus. There's a website out there that's just Back Focus, and it's not correct. All right, guys, that wraps up this episode of Back Focus. A huge thank you to our guests for sharing their time, experience, and passion for astronomy with us today. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. If you're listening on YouTube Music or Spotify or any of the other streaming platforms, please give it a like, share with someone who loves the night sky. Please also consider rating and reviewing the show. It really helps us for discovery as well. You can find links to today's guest, the topics we discussed, and any resources mentioned in the episode description. If you know someone in the astronomy community with a story worth telling, whether they're an astrophotographer, visual observer, educator, club leader, or a content creator, we'd love to hear from them. Visit our website to recommend a guest or get in touch at backfocus.space. Until next time, keep looking up. Thanks for listening to Back Focus, and keep focused.